Everybody's looking for that something. No one ever wants to pay the price. Everybody's scared of going nowhere, but we ain't going anywhere tonight. Oh yeah, I should be more cynical and tell myself it's not okay to feel this good when I'm with you. Try my best to fight it, say I hate you, but I always stay. Ain't nobody love like you do. Everybody's talking about the next
Everybody's talking.
Feel like what they got ain't good enough for.
Alright.
All I wanna do is release the tension.
I just wanna be okay.
Bring the conversation back to us.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. The program is about to begin. Ladies and gentlemen, please silence your cell phones. The program will begin shortly.
Okay.
With and put go.
Take the tables down at Maury's, to the place where Louis dwells, to the dear old temple bar we love so well. Sing the whiff and poofs assembled with their glasses raised on high, and the magic of their singing casts its spell. Yes, the magic of their singing, of the songs we love so well. Shall I Wasting and Mavourneen and the rest? We will serenade our Louis while life and voice shall last.
Then we'll
pass and be forgotten with the rest. We are poor little lambs who have lost our way. Ba, ba, ba. We are little black sheep who have gone astray. Ba, ba, ba. Gentlemen, songsters, off on a spree, damned from here to eternity. God, have mercy on us.
such as we. Ba-ba.
This is Yale Explores, a community of lifelong learners coming together to examine and address the issues shaping our world and the biggest challenges of our time, so we can deepen our understanding today, teach and inspire the leaders of tomorrow, and innovate, collaborate, and accelerate positive change year after year after year. Drawing on the rich resources and heritage of Yale University and fueled by its faculty, students, and alumni, the thinkers, the doers, the creators, the discoverers, the boundary breakers, the difference makers, those committed to leading and serving, those who never stop exploring. This is Yale Explores. Welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President of the Yale Club of Philadelphia, Mark Kerchak. 69.
Thank you. Good evening. It's wonderful to see so many alumni, parents, and friends here tonight. The Yale community in Philadelphia is clearly thriving, and we hope to do a lot more, and hope to do a lot more together with you, as long as we can continue to stimulate your interest. I have the privilege of serving as the president of the Yale Club, and on behalf of the club and its leadership, I am delighted to welcome you to this Yale Explores event. I'm delighted also to be sponsoring this along with the Graduate School Alumni Association. We are especially grateful to AYA for bringing these scholars and this program to our community. As well, we are thrilled to be in a venue quite so special as the National Constitution Center, and delighted that the center's president and CEO, Jeffrey Rosen, Yale Law School class of 1991, was able to join us earlier for the reception. He sends his regrets that he could not be here today, but his delight that he was able to host this event. If you are a Yale alum of any sort, you are already a member of the Yale Club of Philadelphia, and I encourage you to get involved. A list of our upcoming events, at least the ones that we know about now, is available downstairs on several of the tables. And if you didn't pick one up, please get one on the way out to see what we're scheduling for this semester. There's also information about the Graduate School Alumni Association, and that will be there too. We look forward to meeting you either at the reception later or at some event. I hope you enjoyed this reception and hope that you met old friends or made new friends in the process. Please stay after this program for more food, drink, and discussion. And don't forget to take a photo in the Yale Explorers photo booth, which you probably saw downstairs near one of the bars. Now on to the program. The work of tonight's presenters exemplifies the groundbreaking interdisciplinary collaborations that are increasingly a hallmark of Yale University. Daniel Esty, Yale Law School class of 1986, is the Hill House Professor of Environmental Law and Policy at Yale. His current research focuses on integrating climate change issues into trade rules and procedures, on rethinking environmental policy for the 21st century, and on developing metrics to gauge sustainability performance on corporate, national, and global levels. Ann Kurth, Yale School of Nursing class of 1990, is the Dean of the Yale School of Nursing and the Linda Cook Lorimer Professor of Nursing. Her work focuses on HIV reproductive health and on strengthening health systems in the context of planetary health stresses. Paul Turner is the Acting Dean of Science in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and the Elihu Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. His research examines the evolutionary genetics and genomics of microbes, especially viruses, and their ability to adapt or not to changing environmental stresses. Tonight's moderator is someone many of you will know. Margaret Warner currently serves as a senior fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. Previously, of course, she was chief global affairs correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, public television's flagship nightly news and analysis program. She joined the NewsHour in 1993 after 2 decades as a political, White House, and diplomatic correspondent for Newsweek magazine and for the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Warner is a member of the Yale College class of 1971 and is a former trustee of the university. We're also fortunate to have President Peter Salovey here with us tonight. He will close the discussion with insights on tonight's topics from the perspective of a social psychologist and will highlight Yale's unique ability to play a vital role in addressing the pressing challenges facing our world. So please join me in welcoming Ms. Warner, Dean Kurth, and Professors Esty and Turner to the stage for Yale Explores Planetary Health.
Mark, thank you for that great introduction. Good evening, everybody. It's really a thrill to be here, especially at this stupendous National Constitution Center, which I confess I've never seen before, and to talk about tonight planetary health. This whole concept of the Yale Explores events was developed, the first one was launched in Washington, D.C., and it was really to respond to Yale alums who kept telling the university, you know, we like watching football games together and so on, but we would really like to engage with the university in a way that engages us with the intellectual energy of the university. So that's why these were developed. I have to say, when I walked in tonight, I don't know how many of you walked in that way, I was a little intimidated to realize that we'd have the eyes of numerous bronze founding fathers looking over at us. But finally, I decided to just be inspired by it. So that's it's on that basis, or with that point of view, that we're starting tonight. The Yale Explores concept and each event does the same thing, but on a different topic. It tries to explore a single pressing 21st century issue, but drawing, including some of our dazzling Yale faculty, 3 of whom are here tonight, to look at all from different disciplines, all doing groundbreaking work in these different disciplines, as you've just heard, but whose collaboration is needed to solve or resolve some of the thorniest issues that we face in this century. The premise of the planetary health discipline, or some people call it a movement, is that human health cannot be separated from the health of the planet. That we have, to sustain human civilization, we have taken much from the earth, you know, from the oceans and the waters and the air and the resources underground, and that, but that sort of blank check, if you will, is running out, and that we are not going to prosper, all of us, unless we study and come up with solutions that include both human and the health of the planet. So, and I want to say right now, and I know climate change is everyone's favorite or dreaded issue, but it's about more than climate change. I mean, we have exploited and used, and in some cases depleted the earth in many, many ways, as I said, from our air to, you know, the water and arable land. So the question is, can we combine human health and planetary health? Or can we combine human health and the environment's health into planetary health? And just to give you an idea of the trouble we're in, I want to look at these opposing trajectories. Human health has been getting better over the last, we're going to look at 65 years, from 1950 to 2015. Now, it's really not that long ago after all. I mean, some people in this room were alive in 1950. So not all, but some, a few are babies. So we're going to start here with human health, and it's a pretty nice picture. If we look at, first of all, population, the one on the left, it's the first marker of how much human health has improved, and that is that the population on this planet, thanks to nutrition and medical care and sanitation and education, the world's population has tripled from 1950, from 2.6 billion people to 7.6 billion people, even though the birth rate is slowing dramatically. The second chart there is another marker of the improving human condition, and that is the rate of poverty. Now, the UN, this is using the UN measurement, defines poverty as living on the equivalent of $1.90 a day or below. I don't, you know, that's hard for us to fathom. But the dropping poverty rate is just really eye-popping. We can see that in 1950, literally three-quarters of the people on the planet, 72%, lived in poverty by that definition. In 2015, only 10% did. So that's really quite an astounding improvement. And finally, on the right chart, on the very right, life expectancy, it's another telltale measure of the quality of, or at least the health of humans. In 1950, global life expectancy, we're talking about the whole globe here, was 47. In 2015, again, the average, babies born in 2015 on average can expect to live till 72. And when you consider parts of the world where the life expectancy is still 40 or 45, that's really astonishing. Now let's look at the health of our planet. And I think you will agree that it's not as nice a picture. On the left chart, we have the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, the human and plant life needs carbon dioxide to function, but we clearly have too much. For perspective, I just want to say that before the Industrial Revolution and kind of industrial pollution, CO2 concentration in the atmosphere was at 280 parts per million. We see now that it's gone from 310 in 1950 to 400 in 2015. In other words, it's more than doubled since what it was before the Industrial Revolution. Now, the chart in the middle, energy consumption, global energy consumption, in reality, despite all, you know, the renewables, it is primarily from oil, gas, and anyway, from non-renewable resources, coal, thank you very much. And so it's a very bad picture. It's exploded more than fivefold since 1950. In other words, even though we conserve energy and use it far more efficiently than we did in 1950, 5.5 times more of the planet's finite energy resources are being consumed. Finally, on the far right, we see water, global water consumption. It's more than tripled, in fact, 3.5 times since 1950. Now, just to put this in our, cement this in our brain, let's look again at the slide one. Very nice picture. Slide two, not a good picture. So I want to start out by asking what I asked to myself when I embarked on this panel, thinking about this panel, which is it really as bad as all this? In other words, we've had, since the 1950s, people have been crying that the sky is falling because of the environmental degradation, and now it's 65 years later. So I want to ask first our panelists here, our professors, about actual evidence that this, in fact, is happening, that the degradation of the planet is affecting human health. And let me start with Ann Kurth, Professor Kurth, who is, of course, our health and public health expert.
Thank you, Margaret. And it's really a pleasure to see all of you here. Actually, I'm going to evoke Charles Dickens, The Best of Times, Worst of Times, and in some ways that encapsulates it. There has been tremendous progress in human health advances in aggregate. You look at that survival and life duration curve, that's 5.5 years gained overall globally, over 9 years in sub-Saharan Africa. That's tremendous progress. That said, we are now seeing, and there's agreement by 97% of all climate scientists, that the strains on the underlying systems that actually keep all life afloat, not just human life, are under tremendous strains and perhaps approaching what are called planetary boundaries. What do we see? Extreme weather events, climbing temperatures, heat and drought, encroachment of deserts, which means less farmland, which means people will be forced to migrate, as you would if that was happening to you, your sustenance was taken away. So we're going to see all kinds of both direct and indirect health effects that will be mediated by these drivers, which, as Margaret rightly said, not just climate damage, but these other issues that I just outlined, and that if we don't take action, will result in tremendous strain, hurting the poorest first, hurting the most vulnerable first, the ones who contributed the least. 90% of emissions have been put out there by those of us in the 10% who are the highest earners. But it will affect all of us. So the message is, these events are happening, and they are stresses that will eventually affect all of us. Who lives on right near the water here in Philly? Who lives near the bay? Delaware Bay? So you will see James Hansen, who, of course, is one of the first climate scientists who pointed out the fact of greenhouse gas emissions and the problems that those were creating, is also now talking about rising oceans. So just because of the greenhouse gas effect that we've had, that's baked in, we're going to see expansion of the oceans, and that means that here in Philadelphia, you will see more storms, you will see hurricane events on the Atlantic, and it will raise the levels of the Delaware Bay. So just to think about this affecting yourselves as well as people around the world.
And can I just ask a follow-up? Can you give me an example of human health, not in people who are forced to move, but just being affected by environmental degradation today?
Certainly. So 7 million people die every year, preventable deaths, just from air pollution. Would you have thought it was that level? That's more than HIV, malaria, and TB deaths combined. You've heard of all that, right? Right? So the particulate matter that we're putting out into the air with our industrial lifestyles that has afforded some of these health advances is actually having a tremendous impact there. Actual mortality, as well as cognitive effects, we now understand. So now what politician in any country, China or the US or anywhere, wants to have their children be less smart because of the air they're breathing? So we can think about motivators. We do see direct effects.
Paul, let me turn to you next. You're a biologist, an evolutionary biology specialist, an ecology specialist. What do you see in terms of effects today?
Yeah, first, hello, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm very happy to take part in this. So I think the most obvious thing is the biodiversity of species on the planet. I mean, it is so dramatically impacted by human activities, clearly in recorded history. And even when you think about geologic time, when you look very far back into the Earth's past, we define time periods of this Earth by the fauna and the flora that are present. And so much has changed due to human activity in modern times that it's argued that we are in a new geologic period called the Anthropocene. So some of that is human ego. We go around naming geologic periods after ourselves. I'm not so sure if that's warranted. But it is very true that you have this background extinction rate all the time on this planet. That's not something that most humans want to hear, but 99.999% of all species have gone extinct that have ever appeared. So that probably is our fate eventually. The problem is we're hastening that fate for the organisms around us. So we have all these communities, natural communities, that are not very populated with species anymore. And as you look at the way that the Earth's environments are degrading, then naturally this is only going to get worse and worse over time. And it's unclear how important is that. Clearly, there's enough research in biology that if you have a lot of species in a community, it tends to stabilize the community. And as you start removing species from it, then all sorts of equilibria and collapse can occur. So these are not good signs for the future of the Earth. Maybe something we can talk about is a more ethereal topic of psychologically, what does biodiversity do for humans? You know, I was born in Philadelphia. My early years were spent here, and I remember going to the Philadelphia Zoo, which is still here. I saw it on the train ride in, and it's kind of, I can't really put my finger on why something is aesthetically pleasing about encountering other life of different types. But I think many people believe that. I'm not even sure there's a good theory or explanation for it. So that is also concerning to me. As we go into the future and my children and my grandchildren, they're going to be in a world that is impoverished when you think of species biodiversity. It's a little unclear what that does to the human psyche.
Paul, I do want to jump in because I think it's very important that you brought up mental health because we are certainly seeing effects, not just of acute trauma like being displaced and post-traumatic stress disorder, but the actual loss of environment is called solastalgia. There's actually a name for it. And when we design clinics and hospitals, we now realize that just showing green space actually has an impact on faster release from the hospital and shorter duration of stay. So that human and environment connection to nature is palpable.
Fascinating. I've learned at least one thing tonight because I didn't even know.
Dan, you're our lawyer, our policy person, our businessman. How do you see, and you really have a devotion to the whole climate change issue, what evidence do you see that we're already doing damage to human health? Aside from, I know we all know about natural disasters, but other ways.
So I think one of the things that Anne brought up that we want to remember is that we call climate change and not global warming, because it's probably going to be other things that hit us first. Mm. So it is the sea level rise. It's the reality of changed rainfall patterns, of increased droughts, and as a result, fires. In other places, floods. So it's all these other changes that are going to affect us. And I think we're starting to see this with very hot days, and people are dying in hot weather. We're seeing people affected by fires, where this is a severe trauma. But we're seeing a whole lot of other more subtle changes, including change in what food is available, where we're going to fish, where we're going to farm. And I think all of this threatens to undo patterns that have been established over thousands of years. And frankly, if we could change over thousands of years, we might be okay. But changing over decades is going to be much tougher.
So let's look at one of the necessities of life. Let's take food. So who's our agriculture expert? Would I turn to you, Paul?
I'll try.
That actually in certain harsh environmental conditions, the essential nutrients in wheat will diminish or do diminish. Can you explain?
Right. So essentially, life forms, they've evolved to grow under certain environmental conditions. And when you change those conditions, the physiology and the composition of those life forms is not necessarily going to be the same. So even the food that we rely on for our own health could change dramatically in a future world or a current world with global warming, all sorts of environmental impacts that are changing these organisms. And in a sense, they can make them less nutritious. It's also reminding me of when we mentioned fishing. I mean, everybody's probably heard of overfishing and how big of a problem this is. That's because so many humans rely on fish for their source of protein. And the warming of the ocean acidification, is changing the distribution of species in the ocean, including fishes. And this makes some stocks inaccessible to people, and they'll switch to eating something else. Well, that may not be as much of a nutritious food source. And also, strangely, you can get overfishing happening and depletion of food stocks, and people can turn to something else. And in certain areas of the world, they'll turn immediately to bushmeat, what is called just hunting things in the wild. So in certain parts of the world, especially sub-Saharan Africa, that lends itself to encountering these animals that could be reservoirs for infectious disease agents, especially viruses, such as Ebola virus. And suddenly you get overfishing linked to alternative food sources, linked to the spread of a very nasty pathogen, such as Ebola virus, and an outbreak.
So is that happening today?
Yes. That's actually that's a true story. That has happened.
Are you saying Ebola came from that source?
I'm saying that the risk of Ebola infection in humans can be many-fold, but one of them would be switching to an alternative food source, and that being wild game that is ordinarily not hunted. and suddenly humans are encountering a virus that they don't usually see and can be quite deadly.
And there are at least 350 emerging or re-emerging pathogens that are being affected because we are moving into their space, as you point out. And to the point about nutrition, again, progress isn't always linear. We've gone, ironically, from a world where undernutrition was the major problem, historically, to now overnutrition. We may yet go back the other way, right? Where both the micronutrient availability as well as just overall calories will be strained, and that will be put us in a new place.
And I just wanted to add one thing. I think it's also important to note that where we have all these problems, we also, in some places, have solutions emerging. Yes. And I think it's important not to be entirely down about this, because there are some problems that were severe public health crises that we've actually addressed in a major way, including ones that have environmental origins. Perhaps the greatest success in the linked worlds of planetary health, environmental public health, and what an environmental policy person might pay attention to is getting lead out of the environment. Mm-hmm. Now, it is the case we still have residual problems, but they're problems that were put there 100 years ago. In the last couple of decades, we've taken lead out of gasoline, lead out of paint, and most places have realized they need to get lead out of their water pipes. Now, there are some poor communities, and this is where these issues come back around, that haven't been able to do that, Flint, Michigan most famously, but frankly, a lot of older cities still. And yet, we know how to solve that problem. What I think is curious is that some of these bigger planetary challenges, we haven't had the same bearing down on where the solutions can be found and figuring out what the obstacles are. And yet I would say, and maybe this is a question for Anne, public health seems to have been very good at that, while the environmental arena much less so.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really important to think about solutions, and we do have them. So yes, this is happening. This is happening now. It's happening to you and your generation. This is not your grandchildren. It may affect you less, somewhat. Those of us who've had the wonderful opportunity to be at Yale may have more resources, but it will affect everyone. And I hope we talk a little bit about the moral question here. Yes. In terms of equity. But there is good news about what we can do. And you gave a wonderful example there, Dan, with the lead from science, to understanding the impact, to policy action that's pulled through, both at the sort of legislative level and community level and market level. And that is really where there is movement and momentum in this space around the planetary health drivers and challenges. It may not be just the nation states as the actors, and now I'm tipping into your realm, so please jump in, but we see cities, we see mayors, we see regional cooperation, taking action in terms of local planning to both reduce the impact on the planet in terms of energy, transport, food systems, et cetera, as well as to get ready for some of the changes that will come. And that's an area that I'm very interested in, is getting health systems ready for some of the inevitable elements that will be happening. But there is certainly movement, and it is the case that the sort of transition from dirty, outdated fossil fuels to green renewables and a green energy future is happening now in the market. 5 years more funding in renewables than in oil in the last over the last 5 years, and so there's already a transition underway that it doesn't even have to be legislated in some regards because people are moving towards seeing the opportunities involved in transitioning to more green energy, and so that's an encouraging element. But then there is also this local action that's being driven at the community level, and you do want to have strong, resilient communities and not just rely on nation states to somehow magically solve problems that are quite, deep.
While we're having this discussion about solutions, let me just raise technology, because I think many people in the developed world think, well, nothing so bad that technology and technological events can't solve. Can innovative technologies dig us out of this hole? Or is it, I don't know, is the precipice always moving, but it's always still there?
So I would
No, you go.
So I would just start, and then we'll let Paul finish, by saying what's amazing in public health is how much technology has brought us forward in the last three decades. Exactly. And I look at the environmental arena, and I'm shocked how little innovation has taken place, how few things are changed. You know, the fossil fuel foundation of our society has evolved only from coal to oil in the last 100 years, but it's otherwise been pretty much the same. The electricity grid, virtually the same as 100 years ago. So we have a lot that has not moved very much. So one of the questions, and professors love puzzles, this is what gets us excited and gets us up in the morning, why has Ann's arena moved so fast with so much innovation, and why has the one that I spend time in moved so slowly? That's a real conundrum.
Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, I was just going to say a quick thing about agriculture and how technology can help feed a hungry world. Genetic engineering of plants is not that different than what we've been doing historically in domestication. I mean, we take teosinte and other organisms and turn them into corn that's juicy and, you know, yummy to eat. We essentially were tinkering with genetics before we knew what genetics really was. So I do take some issue with people assuming that genetic engineering is bad. We eat genetically engineered foods all the time. I think there are cultural biases against it that are real, and this is one way that biologists and those who are working in agricultural realms need to work with others on these problems. But, you know, this is what we're faced with now. Are we going to be eating alternative food sources, or are we going to be manipulating, say, plants so that they can grow in more regions that are subject to drought? You know, it is possible these days to engineer plants so that they can grow under very water-stressed conditions. And this is really what I think is a fine solution to help feed a hungry world.
You mean it, as long as there's not too much political resistance.
Right.
I had sort of maybe an answer to your riddle or puzzle is, when you're trying to change the energy sources on which our economy runs, there are obviously so many ingrained interests that want to keep it the same. In public health, but correct me if I'm wrong, Anne, I think, well, who would argue with trying to make every society, poor and rich, healthier?
Right. Yes, there is a universality to public health, that it is literally a public good. And we know, for example, that educating girls has a direct effect on fertility, which has a virtuous cycle of the children who live, fewer children who live longer, contribute to the economy, et cetera. Let me tell you a story. Again, when I worked in sub-Saharan Africa many years ago, I met a woman who had lost 15 out of 18 children. Think about that life. And that same country where I work now in Kenya, many of my colleagues and many of the women in the villages have many fewer children. The girls are educated, you know, and it's a whole different life trajectory. So some of the things that health care and public health aim for are just so universally appreciated, I think, at an instinctive level, that there's room for it. And a small technological advance, small relatively speaking, in terms of perhaps contraceptive effectiveness, can have a huge impact. Coming back to what you said, Margaret, and to your point, Dan, let's be honest, there are entrenched interests, and fossil fuel subsidies are estimated to cost about $5.3 trillion a year. About half of that is direct health costs, which right now are not paid for, right, by the industry. That's more than countries spend on health care. Right? So if we shift some of the subsidies, so again, the market is going to move towards seeing the utility in green energy and renewables. And the countries that move forward in that more quickly are going to do better in the long run.
Let me just press you a little bit on that, though, because you're saying, well, the public health arena is easier because people are all going to be better off. Isn't that true of the environment, too? I'm surprised.
Say that again, Dan.
Saying the environment arena is not unlike public health in that people should be celebrating movement towards a cleaner planet as well as cleaner, you know, personal lives, the ones of better health. And I think there are entrenched interests in the medical arena. The world of people that were selling leeches has gone away. And yet the sellers of fossil fuels persist. So I think it's an interesting question still. What is it? Now, I'm going to give just a couple of answers, and then maybe you guys both can tell me if I'm wrong. One, I think there's been a lot of investment in data, in environmental, in public health, and less so in environment. Mm-hmm. And so we've had really good data. And second, people trust their medical professionals. Mm-hmm. So when you go to the doctor and the nurse, and they say, here's what the data shows, you need to reduce your cholesterol, you don't dispute them. You don't say, I'm sorry, no, I can't be right. And even more dramatically, if they tell you, well, your heart needs surgery, you don't say, well, we'll worry about that 5 years from now. And yet in the environment arena, that's what we do all the time, or at least that's what happens, is people either deny and reject the expert advice or say, let's push it off. And, you know, God forbid in your field, people push off. You don't make it to that surgery 10 years from now.
Exactly, and it's human nature. So Tony Lieserwitz, who's at Yale and who actually received a Climate Trailblazer Award 2 weeks ago at the Global Climate Action Summit that Jerry Brown and others put together in California, he talks about how to use science, communication, and psychology to talk about these issues. And there's a classic map, two maps that his work developed that was featured in the New York Times. You all may have seen it, right? That map of, do you believe climate damage is happening now in the United States? Yes, almost everybody in every state believes it. The next map is, do you think it's going to hurt you personally? Right. So I think there's that using data effectively, but then being able to really take it in and not be so overwhelmed by it, but find a path forward to actually take action is what we need to do.
Yeah, these are great topics. So on the subject of data science, I was happy to be part of President Salovey had a University Science Strategy Committee, and we tried to think in the next 10 years, where can Yale go with science? And very near the top, you know, someone considered the top initiative we might undertake is data science and its mathematical foundations. I mean, you have so much access now to environmental data through satellites and remote sensing, and you have all sorts of probes that can be placed in the environment. But, you know, it's very hard to know what to do with all of the data. And believe me, I'm the king of projection maps. I love to show people projection maps in talks and show them, hey, look, with global warming, you've got mosquito distributions shifting into areas where people had not been exposed to these mosquitoes, and they are going to be suffering from maladies like dengue fever, etc. I mean, it is going to happen. So all of that does come together through understanding of scientists working with people who are doing climate change models and certain projections from those and trying to figure out what the future world looks like. But this is really, really difficult to do. And, you know, really the issue with it is not very proximate. So you can scare an audience, you can maybe give them a solution alongside it, but they still don't consider it as their life today because it is a projection map. It's talking about the future. And it's a challenge to think, how do you care for and try to avoid the environmental degradation that we know is going on from the standpoint of, we must stop it now so that this projection map does not look like this in 2050, which is not very far off.
Can I ask you all how much of the degradation, such a loaded word, of the planet that we have seen in the last 50, 60 years is just because our population has really grown exponentially, literally exponentially. It's projected to hit 10 billion, I think, by 2050, according to the UN. How much of it is just there are more people trying to get in the door and get what the store has versus actual destruction by human activity?
So I would tell you in the arena that I work in, the field of industrial ecology has a three-part equation, and it identifies impacts as a function of population, affluence, mm-hmm. so consuming more, every person not just is an addition, but every richer person is an addition. And you saw the extraordinary growth in affluence over the last 70 years. And then technology. And technology is tricky because it's a you know, two-part story. Some technologies reduce harm, reduce emissions, reduce impact, and others add to the demand for electricity, add to the demand for energy. So you have to sort of work those as a system and understand that population alone is an important factor, but not the only factor. And quite frankly, we could have managed if it were just a population issue. It's all the rest of this. And frankly, it's the failure to address the dual nature. Anne said this in her opening comment, that all the things that made the advances in human health possible were driven by an economy mm-hmm. that allowed us to put a lot of money into medical research. But there was a downside. And a not too hidden downside, which was all the energy that drove that economy was not being attended to in a serious way in terms of the pollution impacts.
And just one personal anecdote. You see that disjunction. I was in Afghanistan reporting. And in Afghanistan, as you may remember, in the George W. Bush administration, Laura Bush got very interested in not only girls' education, but health. And there was a whole hospital built, the state-of-the-art Child's Hospital in a remote southern portion of the country. But they had no electricity to run the machines. It cost like billions of dollars. It wasn't regular electricity. The electricity goes on and off. They didn't have the trained people. They didn't have the water source. So it was a complete disaster. And, you know, that just illustrates this tension that we have here. What about water? Because of all the depletion rates or whatever we looked at, water is really extreme. How are you going to solve that? Because that, even if you, okay, let me ask you. If you took all the rivers that have been polluted, I mean, most of those, a great many in this country have been cleaned up. How much is it just that we're going to run out of water?
Yeah. So a lot of our water we rely on is groundwater.
Yes.
And part of the Earth's natural cycle is to replenish the groundwater, but we're using it so quickly it's not being replenished nearly in time to make up for how much we're drawing from groundwater. So that's a tough one. You know, that's a different issue than even drinking water that could be done through desalination plants from ocean water. I have a lot more optimism over that and increasing efficiency to do that. But I'm not quite sure how you replenish groundwater. Maybe my colleagues have heard something about this that I don't know. I think it's a real energy challenge in order to do that.
It is an energy challenge because, you know, if you look again at more, most of that water use is agriculture.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that comes back to what kinds of foods we've developed.
Technologies around drip irrigation,
right.
Conservation measures. So, you know, Cape Town, as you all heard, you know, this summer it nearly ran out of water. You know, they're getting by. So there are efficiencies that we can try for. But there is a story to be told, much like the story you told about vectors and encroachment of humans and what that how that can play out into disease patterns. Dan could tell the story better. But as we think about Syria, right, the issue around water there, the impact of drought, how that drove people into the cities, how there were no jobs then for the young men, how then actually neoliberal policies shifted water subsidies so that there was huge increases in cost of water, all of these elements contributing. So I think as we talk mm-hmm. about human needs and behaviors, the animal world, we also have to think about the politics of this and how will we interact with each other to ensure that we bring out the best in human nature rather than the worst. And I would say the good news is, although obviously in situations of extreme resource constraint and lack of structure or support, things can go quite awry. In general, people do respond. In acute crisis, they respond with their best selves in the local community, trying to be responsive to their neighbors. And so we need to somehow extend that, both the metaphor of crises, because all these trends we're talking about are more like a slow-moving emergency. Mm-hmm. It's not happening fast enough right in front of your eyes, like a tower falling on 9/11 or a hurricane, that people don't always see it as quickly. But there are ways to rally people, and I think that we do have to pay attention to the political and frankly, ethical aspects of ensuring
that. Dan, weigh in. This is
something you feel. Yeah, I want to maybe even take issue with Ann a little bit in the spirit of Yale, where we don't always agree and we push back on each other. So I think it is partly about politics, but it's also about policy design. And I think the fundamental problem, and the answer to your question, Margaret, is we haven't made people pay for what they took out of nature. And, you know, we've been able for free to take the water we wanted, and the farmers have taken an awful lot and left too little for the cities. And so what I'm going to push back on is I think it's not that we raised the prices too much on people, it's that we haven't made people pay for a whole lot of what they've taken from nature. Not only the water, but they haven't paid for what they put up in the air, using the atmosphere as a garbage dump for our greenhouse gases. So I would like to propose, and again, in the spirit of hypotheses to get at these problems, we need a fundamentally different 21st century planetary health policy framework. And I would say there's, you know, much more emphasis on data. That was hypothesis one, as the medical world has done. Hypothesis two, make people pay for the harm they cause. No polluting for free. The basic model has been pollute up to a certain line, then you're prohibited above that. But up to a certain level, it's okay. Why? Why should we be able to take anything from society as a whole, including our clean air or our water? So I say, better data, and then make people pay for the water they take, the trees they cut down, the fish they pull out of the ocean, and the pollution they put in the sky.
Yet that means that all those things and the products created from them will cost a lot more. I mean, you could say we can pay for more at the grocery store, but what about going to the moral dimension here, the socioeconomic dimension? I mean, if you were charging farmers, you know, rural farmers in India for the water they use, I mean, how practical is that?
Do you want me to answer? All right.
Yes.
My theory is there are separable issues here. There are important questions of equity and fairness, but there are ways to address that. If you want to make people pay for water but worry about a segment of the population that can't pay, offer a baseline amount of water for free and then you pay above that. Or, alternatively, you provide income support and then make everyone pay for everything, which I actually like better. You also can transition the price in over time. With regard to greenhouse gas emissions, you know, I do believe there should be a price on every unit of carbon dioxide or other emissions you throw into the atmosphere. And people would be jarred, perhaps, by having to pay for it today. Why not a $5 per ton fee next year, rising by $5 per ton per year for 20 years? So you'll get to start from a $5 fee per ton to a $100 fee over a 20-year time frame. Everyone can phase in, new technologies will be spurred, you can adjust more easily, so it won't be jarring, although you'll still have to deal with certain people at the low end of the income spectrum who are not well positioned to pay anything.
Well, Paul's about to jump out of his chair.
This is fascinating to me, and I think that as an outsider looking in, the obvious question that I have is, who's going to do the policing? I mean, are we going to have countries really going to get on board with this and everybody look after their own and levy this? Or do you think the world can come together and do this? I'd love to hear your take on that.
So a quick answer would be, my view is the world has made a fundamental error and talked about the need to move away from national governments driving all of these policies. I think that's part of the story. I think we know that national governments get stuck and they don't actually respond very well to things that are better dealt with at a state or provincial level, or many, many things now at a city scale. But I would also say we don't all have to have the same target and timetable. So, you know, we spent a whole lot of time, including me. I have been a negotiator of the American position on climate change when I spent time at the EPA. And I think all of us who negotiated in the 20th century got a couple of things fundamentally wrong. First, that the whole story was about targets. It turned out we didn't pay attention to implementation. We made what I like to call the lawyer's mistake. And I apologize in advance to the lawyers in the crowd. The lawyer's mistake is to think if you pass a law, write regulations, sign a treaty, the job is done. Nobody in business would think that. They would think you've written your mission statement. They would ask, what's the execution plan? How do you change behavior? What are the incentives? Mm-hmm. No one asked those questions. I didn't ask those questions. I bear a lot of guilt for having got us off in such a bad track. The real answer, of course, is you've got to bear down much harder. And I think in health we have. You ask the question, what do we need to do to change people's behavior? What works? What doesn't work? Will nudges work? Do rules have to be in place? Second big element at the global scale was to think we had to do it all in lockstep. So I say, first, let's not have emissions targets, but a price target. Make everyone aim for $100 a ton carbon charge or carbon equivalent. But you decide when you get there. 20 years was my goal for the US. Maybe it's 50 for India, or 60, 40 for China. You can give people different time frames consistent with their level of development, and I think reduce the unfairness and get people more or less on board. The final point would be, we all don't have to do it the same way at all. Maybe my view of a price is not as easy to do in India. You could do alternative pathways to get to a similar outcome. So I think diversity of circumstance argues for diversity of policy. And I think we've underattended to that as part of the story as well.
We have fewer than 9 minutes left. So since the premise of all this is planetary health and this new discipline about how your three disciplines and many others can collaborate, I'm going to start with Anne. Give me an can you give me an example in which you would, the public health and health community would work more with, say, the biologists in our society? It sounds like a great buzzword, planetary health, but give me a concrete example of either how it's working now or how it could work.
Sure. And, you know, this is really about perhaps the premier complex problem of our century, right? Honestly. And so you need all disciplines in order to address that. You absolutely do. And so there's a key role for universities like Yale and others to be engaged in this work. Part of it starts with education. So there is a group of us who are working on developing planetary health curricula that can be used, a global curricula that can be used across different levels of education, including the university level. We are working together effectively across a consortium of universities interested in global health, because this is sort of the next, this is global health 2.0, to think about the planetary-wide impact. And so all of those groups are coming together and sharing best practices, because this is about talking to an engineer and talking to a virologist and talking to an anthropologist and an economist, because that is the only way to really address these issues in a cohesive and evidence-based way, figure out what fails, figure out what works. And so Yale is doing that, and I think Yale is actually uniquely positioned to address planetary health. We have this incredible FES, we have an amazing law school, we have the health science schools. We have so many assets that actually can be brought together with strength to focus on this premier problem of our time.
That's great. Yeah, I think that transdisciplinary efforts are obvious what we have to do. And here, maybe I'll plug Yale as well. I think Yale is well poised for this. We have a Yale West campus now where these institutes bring together experts who are coming from different home departments, and they're working in the same thematic area. And that's breaking down the sort of traditional department structures, at least on West campus, so that individuals are next door to those who might bring a different kind of an expertise. But I think we need to go beyond that. A lot of the problems that we face can be addressed through technology, biotechnology, which I'm a fan of, as we talked about before. But without talking to policymakers, without talking to economists, you know, how are you going to solve a problem locally in a laboratory and then actually implement it on a continental scale? And you may be trying to implement this with some states and some countries that don't historically get along very well. So this is, I think, a grand challenge, but it's clearly how the scientists, the engineers, the policymakers, the economists, public health, it can all come together under that umbrella.
And Dan, at what stage could all this influence public policy? For example, the great example you just gave about that you, looking back on it, probably didn't either have the right incentives or understanding of what would really make these targets work. I mean, so how might that, if you'd had input from a broader range?
Well, let me start by saying, I think, again, that the policy framework of the 20th century had a lot of flaws, and I'm about to get another one, and that was we thought what we call environmental media by media. So we had an air program and a separate waste program and a separate water program and a separate chemicals program, and we didn't think in an integrated way. So what you've just heard three in a row, 100% agreement, on the need to bring together these scientific underpinnings and work as a system. So a systems perspective is very, very important. Yes. And you asked for one concrete thing. So I have a team at Yale called the Environmental Performance Index Team that has been creating now for 20 years a framework for understanding at the global scale, but measured at a country level, how various societies are doing on a two dozen different metrics, some of which relate to environmental public health, some of which relate to ecosystem vitality. So actually the two fields represented here. And what we find is that by simply getting pretty good data, not even great data, but pretty good data, and arraying it, people pay attention. Nobody wants to be at the bottom of a league table, as we sometimes call it. And you can identify at the top what's working and do more of it. And frankly, you find best practices and disseminate them. So it turns out there's a lot of opportunity by being more data-driven and then thinking in an integrated way. So again, these are just some of the steps forward to overcome what I think has been the relatively poor policy framework that has inhibited protecting planetary health. And we got a lot to learn from the folks in the medical arena and the personal public health, which seems to have done much better.
And then, but that does raise the question of incentives, because whether it's in a country, industry by industry, or in a university, there's always the competition over resources, and it's hard. How hard is it then to get people to collaborate? Wow. Let's start with Paul.
Unfortunately, it's hard because there aren't a lot of there's not a lot of federal support. Everybody talks about interdisciplinary research, but you know, it's hard to actually get grants to do interdisciplinary projects, and especially bridging across, you know, into economics and hard science. So maybe President Salovey doesn't want to hear me say this, but I think a lot of what is going to happen in the future is that Research One institutions like Yale are going to create these possibilities, maybe some seed funding, make it competitive. You know, Yale has competitive faculty by nature. They will get creative, and they will bridge disciplines, and they'll come up with good ideas. So maybe a little kickstart there will really lead to some amazing things.
And we're overcoming, in this kind of idea, 500 years of academic focus on deeper and deeper, narrower disciplines.
We have to break out.
Ever specializing deeper.
If Yale can't do it, who can?
Exactly.
And we know now, and I think President Salovey has made it a point of his presidency, that we must do the cross-disciplinary conversation and ultimately the research beyond that.
Yeah.
So, but Anne, you've dealt, let's take it outside of the walls of Yale and talk about the United States as a country and the political, I mean, in public health, you see a lot of this. How hard is it there to get, again, this cross-disciplinary collaboration?
Well, I'm actually hopeful, and I think perhaps from part of the success of global health and public health has been that has always been in our nature to draw from a variety of sub-disciplines in order to address the problem at hand, the human health problem at hand. So we're just sort of leveraging that. And I think we've also learned from things like the global HIV pandemic, which was not solved just by basic science. It was also solved by advocates like Greg Gonsalves, who's now actually at the Yale School of Public Health, who was one of the early AIDS activists, who changed the way research was done, the incentives, the funding, the way we conduct the science. In order to accelerate progress in treatment in that case, and I think we can do the same for planetary health.
Well, I want to thank our panelists. This was fascinating and, though somewhat disturbing, also uplifting.
there are
some solutions out there for just there smart enough to and bold enough and brave enough to accept, to seize them. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well said. Really well done.
Thank you. Great job.
Thank you.
So fun to have you. Okay, I've got to just introduce
you. I think we're going to
end this one. I'm waiting 1 second. So now, dessert. I'm going to introduce Peter Salovey, president of Yale, to come and address you.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Martha. I appreciate that. So good evening, everyone, and I'm so glad you're all here this evening. Wasn't it exciting to have Margaret Warner as our guide for tonight's program on planetary health? Yeah. We had three professors speaking tonight, and they exemplify Yale's academic excellence across disciplines. How about a hand for them as well? So I think what our panel illustrated is how Yale knowledge, Yale research, and Yale expertise can help us understand and solve global challenges. That has been our theme in these Yale Explorers programs. Their research focuses on ensuring the health of our environment and the well-being of those who live on the planet is improved. And I want to share with you tonight a few thoughts that come from my own discipline. I won't take too long doing that, I promise. And of course, I look forward to hearing your thoughts when we all join each other downstairs at the post-panel reception. So tonight, you heard from faculty members from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, from the School of Nursing, and from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. And they spoke to you about how they are trying to strengthen global health systems, how they're trying to gauge environmental and sustainability performance worldwide, and how they examine how organisms adapt to overcome environmental challenges. What these contributions demonstrate, I think, is that the collective knowledge of experts across disciplinary boundaries, indeed across the schools of Yale University, is what's needed to address complicated problems like a growing population or changing environment. What is clear to me after hearing tonight's presentation and these thoughtful discussions is that one person, one organization, even one country is not going to be enough to solve these problems of global health, global environmental change. They showed us that it takes interdisciplinary collaborations if you want to take groundbreaking discoveries and move them from the laboratory to the clinic or from the academy to public policy. It requires humans working across cultures, across borders, across generations together to create a shared future. And that's not easy to do. That's not an easy task. Let me give you an example of how hard it is in this area of global health and global environmental change. Let's take the issue of climate change. A few years ago, the Pew Research Center conducted a survey worldwide on concern about climate change. And what they found was that people from China and the United States, two of the countries that emit the most carbon dioxide, were among the least concerned about climate change. On the other hand, many of the people who were surveyed, about half of them, believe that because certain countries have produced most of the world's emissions, they should do more than developing nations to deal with these effects. So you have this mismatch. What Pew also found is that in certain countries, ideological differences creates very divergent views about the threat of climate change. We see that in the United States. You can also see that in Australia, in Canada, in Germany, and in the United Kingdom. So the survey results show us that perceptions about climate change vary depending on what nation you're in, even depending on what region of each nation. So what do we do? How do we galvanize people to contribute to efforts to improve health across the globe? How do we communicate with them more effectively? Well, this is where my field, social psychology, may offer some helpful insights. My own laboratory, when I used to run a laboratory, conducted research on how information is framed and whether it is then persuasive or not. And you can frame information in terms of gains or losses, the benefits of changing your behavior or the risks and costs of not changing your behavior, gains and losses. And we did a lot of research looking at how gain and loss frame messages affect your behavior in areas that might lead to preventing cancer or in behaviors that might lead to preventing HIV and AIDS. Well, this idea can be applied to behaviors that are relevant to promoting environmentally sustainable behavior. And in fact, others have done just this kind of research in Canada, in Australia, in Italy. And the bottom line is that gained frame messages seem to work better than lost frame messages. So let me give you an example that comes from research by Robert Gifford and Louise Comeau. They looked at how 1,000 Canadians, they looked at their willingness to engage with climate change after listening to gain versus loss frame messages. So here's an example of the kind of messages that worked better in promoting an interest in climate change. The economy will be stronger if we act first to cut greenhouse gases. Or, my neighborhood will be healthier, and it'll be healthier to walk in my neighborhood if we cut greenhouse gases. Those were effective messages. But fewer people reported engagement with climate change if they heard loss frame messages. Messages like, I'm going to have to get used to turning out the lights. I'm going to have to drive less. I'm going to have to turn down the heat. Those kind of messages are not very persuasive to people. Here's another psychological principle that really seems to matter and that might make a difference in promoting environmental sustainability. When you learn what your neighbors are doing, you're influenced by it. We are much more willing to conserve energy or use green energy if we hear that our neighbors are doing that. We're much more likely to recycle if everybody on our street is recycling. The flip side is we can make each other aware of what our neighbors are doing and end up normalizing the wrong behaviors. People want to conform with what their neighbors are doing, so we have to make sure we target this in the right way. Let me give you an example of what not to do. So there's a national park in Arizona called the Petrified Forest. You probably have heard of it. And it turned out people were stealing the petrified wood from the Petrified Forest. So somebody got the bright idea to put up signs to try to prevent people from stealing wood in the Petrified Forest. And the signs that they put up actually increased theft. Here's what they said. Visitors in the past have removed the petrified wood from this park, changing the state of the petrified forest. Don't do that. But what that does is it tells you that other people are stealing the wood. Hey, there's a good idea. Let's steal the wood. Right? It actually increased theft. So sometimes well-intentioned messages describing how people are damaging the environment can make us think that it's okay to do it. Everybody's doing it. I used to be worried. I'm not so worried anymore. That's not what we want to do. All right, I give you those examples just to suggest that the complexities of understanding and influencing human behavior to strengthen global health, to overcome environmental challenges, are not going to be solved by a single discipline, by one Yale department, by one Yale school. Leaders in nursing, in environmental and evolutionary science, in social science, in medicine, in public health, they're all going to be needed. And this is where a research university plays a really important role. This is where Yale can play a vital role. We can bring together experts from across disciplines to improve lives. Yale's conducting cutting-edge research in so many different fields, and our students are learning to become agile thinkers. They're developing into leaders who can thrive and help change the world. They'll go on to make remarkable contributions to their professions and to their communities, just as Yale alumni have done for generations, just as all of you do every day. In your efforts, the work of Yale alumni, they reach out across the entire world. You demonstrate that Yale's enriching educational environment extends beyond the boundaries of our campus, beyond New Haven. You know that for us to address global challenges, like the one we discussed this evening, we must constantly broaden our horizons. We can't be entirely local. Well, when you share your wisdom, when you direct talented young scholars to Yale, when you serve your communities, you are setting an outstanding example for our students and for young people all over the world. So, thank you so much for joining us in this endeavor, simply by being here this evening. Thank you as well for all that you do to expand the Yale community here in Philadelphia and through your travels throughout the world. I really look forward to seeing you in a few minutes downstairs at our next reception. Right? The new Yale programs, we don't have just one reception, we have two. It's perfect if you're a psychologist or a public health expert, pre and post, right? Time one and time two. And I look forward to talking to you a bit more about all of this at that reception. Meanwhile, thank you all for being here. And can you join me in one more round of applause for our faculty and for Margaret? Thank you all so much. Thank you. See you downstairs.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being part of Yale Explorers. Now, please join President Salovey and our panelists in the reception area for further discussions. There are two ways to proceed downstairs. You can exit to the left of the stage and visit Signers Hall on your way out, or you can exit the way you came in. And be sure to post your thoughts on this evening to the hashtag Yale Explores. Thank you again. Visit the Signers Hall on the left of the stage before you go downstairs. Thank you.